This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Ping Fu's life in China was the stuff of nightmares. As a child, she was forced to watch soldiers murder two teachers. Her parents were thrown into re-education camps. And she was raped by members of the Red Guard after she saved her sister from drowning. Still, when she got the chance, she went to college and studied journalism and literature. She wrote a thesis about the practice of infanticide in China. Her paper was picked up by the press in China and eventually went global. The story proved a deep embarrassment to the Chinese government. She was thrown into prison and eventually deported. That final insult turned into a blessing. Ping Fu came to the United States, went to college, and started a software business. Today, she's the CEO of a 3D software company here in the area. It's called Geomagic. Her clients include NASA, NASCAR, and Fisher-Price. The company's success even caught the attention of President Barack Obama, and that got Ping an invitation to last year's State of the Union address. Ping Fu, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go back to those days in China, growing up during the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward. First, describe for us what that was. What was going on in China at the time?
Great Leap Forward was Mao's call to be an industrial superhouse. And the goal was to produce more steels than the United States and England. And we actually destroyed the whole country's economy by turning all the useful steels like cooking pots and machinery into pieces of nuggets. And we may have produced more steels, but they're not useful. And that itself actually sent China into trouble in the 60s, early 60s.
And in the process of doing that, of course, there was a kind of a cultural revolution, the idea that the country had lost its sense of the revolution. So intellectuals thrown into jail, children taken from their families, and that happened to your family as well.
Yeah, that's right. And when the country's economy went into trouble, Mao kind of slowly lose his power, and that's why he started Cultural Revolution. And of course, all the educated people like my parents were sent to exile. And we were deemed to be black elements. We were not even people. We were born black. We were there to redeem the sin our parents committed.
So this Great Leap Forward failed. It was your fault, right? According to the government. And your parents were doing what at the time?
My father was an aeronautic professor, and my mom is in finance. And then they both were sent to, my father was sent to the border of Russia, cutting trees, making furniture. He was doing that for 12 years. And then my mother was sent to countryside to farm.
And you and your sister?
I was 8 when that happened, and my sister were 4. She was too young to work, so I started work at 8. Cultural Revolution was in its totality 12 years. It's a 10 plus 2, and that was my K-12.
Wow. Education. So describe that. Describe that education.
I was in first grade when Cultural Revolution started, and then school completely closed. The teacher were either sent to jail, abused, or went to exile, just like my parents. We didn't have any class, so we went to work in the countryside, in the factory. Sometimes later, I also went to military training. Mao said we need to study from the workers and farmers and soldiers. We did study some intellectual concept with the kids because I was kind of in the younger generation of those black elements. The older kid will sometimes teach us concepts like mathematics or physics. For example, what is the fastest way to add from 1 to 100? That's 1 plus 99, 2 plus 98, so on and so forth. Or if you have 2 people on the bicycle and 1 person on the bicycle, you go downhill, which one is faster? Now, intuitively, the heavy one should be slower, and we tried the heavy one is faster. That's how we learned acceleration and gravity.
Now, is this something you'd get in trouble for if you were caught teaching other students or learning these kind of concepts?
You can get in trouble. Some older kids doing that being considered bourgeois, and I've seen one boy got killed and others being thrown in jail.
And you describe this term that the Chinese government would use. They would describe you as black elements or bourgeois. These were terms they used to say. How were you taking that, internalizing that at the time? I mean, how did that make you feel about yourself?
It was very difficult at beginning because when I was young, I was very loved. Suddenly, this happened, and I was in first grade. That's the time when you learn, and you've been told that you were born evil, and you will never have the opportunity to turn this over. Basically, you have to spend your life to redeem whatever your grandparents and your parents did. I resented it, and I also felt very, at the beginning, very sad that I was born into a bad family, basically. But I also think children are very resilient. I was young. I didn't know any better. And also, it wasn't just happened to me. It was happened to a group of people. So there were other kids are just like me. And that made it a little easier.
Tell us what happened to your teachers. Two of them were murdered right before your eyes, right?
Right. That was like a very first week when we were sent into this children's ghetto. We were collected in the soccer field and witnessed two teachers being killed. One was tied on four horses and pulled apart, and we saw her guts falling on the lawn, and which is very gruesome. And another teacher was put head down into a well to drown. Mm-hmm. And then we were told that if we were ever do anything bad or being disobeying any order, this is what we will end up to be.
Wow. Is this what happened to all sort of every new group that came in? Or
they do different things. Yeah. Some get taken to see execution, but yeah, every group gets scared.
And these guards who were over you, many of them were not much older. They were in their teens and early 20s.
Right. There's red guards. They are typically teens and late teens, 15 to 20. And then you also have the workers and soldiers. They are usually a little older.
And they were, as you suggest, brutal at times. In fact, at one point, they threw your sister into a river, into the water?
That's right. At the teenage age, when Mao said, you are the master of the country, and then you have been living in the bottom of the society, now you can do anything to those people. They do crazy things. And there was what I heard from the Red Guards were that there's also a lot of peer pressure. So one day I heard screaming outside the dormitory where my sister and I lived. Hong is in the water. That's Hong is my sister's name. And looked out, saw her struggling in the canal that was in front of our dorm. I ran out and jumped in to pull her out. And then I did save her life, but I was gang raped by Red Guard, and they also cut me up with a knife and left me there to die.
How old were you?
I was 10 years old.
How did you recover from that?
Yeah, it was at that point, I think I really wanted to die. I didn't think life was worth living, but I think my sister kept me there because I was her surrogate mother, and there is another life depending on me. I couldn't just die.
When did this internalization of all these sort of horrors that they were calling you? You said you were worried that you had been born into this kind of a family. Was there a turning point for you, a point at which you realized it's not your fault, it's not, in fact, what they're doing is wrong?
Before Cultural Revolution started, my uncle sensed things will happen, so he already started to educate me. Of course, I didn't quite understand what's happening. He told me, Ping, you have to be bamboo, that in the prevailing wind you bend, but you never break. And I always remember him saying that. And the other thing he said to me was, if someone do bad things to you, that doesn't make you a bad person. And you don't want to be them. And you want to withhold your value and stand straight. And you would always be you, no matter what they say to you. So those value system that he instilled in me was very important. I don't know that I ever really felt that I was worthy of anything. But I knew I was different, and I know being good would save me. So that's kind of, I just lived and then lived well and then do good things and not to do anything that I don't like, as what my uncle once told me. Over the time, the country get a little bit less crazy. People, even if they're Red Guards or they are in the Red class, there are also kind people. They just kind of in that group. I did see a lot of kindness, even in the very dark age. So I noticed that if there are people trying to help us.
Did you know what was happening to your parents at that time?
No, we have no connections. My dad was basically gone, and my mother came back when I was 13. And thereafter, I lived with her, so I know where she is.
We will continue our conversation on the state of things, talking today with Ping Fu, CEO of GeoMagic, a software company here at RTP. Just ahead, we'll find out how Ping's success in college got her kicked out of China. You'll find out that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking with Ping Fu. She is CEO of GeoMagic, a 3D software company in Research Triangle Park. She grew up in China during the Cultural Revolution, and before the break we were talking about her early life. Eventually you did go to college. Things changed. Chairman Mao died, and things opened up a little bit. Tell us about going to college and what you studied.
After Cultural Revolution was over, China reopened its university. I studied Chinese literature. I didn't have a choice on what major. I really wanted to be an astronaut, but I took the opportunity to go to and study Chinese literature.
And what kinds of things were you learning? I mean, was it difficult for you? I mean, was it torture for you studying what you didn't want to, or did you find it interesting?
I found it very interesting, actually. I'm not looking back. I'm glad I did. In the late 70s and early 80s, that was the most open period of China. That's where some of the most respected artists, like director Zhang Yimou and artist Ai Weiwei, were all in my generation. So it was really a prolific area, a prolific age of ideology.
Were you able to, through Chinese literature, contextualize what the Cultural Revolution was, the Great Leap Forward, and what had happened to you?
Yeah, through studying literature, what I have realized is that the China that I lived through is not the China that I should know. So I learned thousands of years history of China and its culture, and that made being a Chinese that much easier.
It made it that much easier.
Yeah.
Yeah. And eventually then you wrote a paper on infanticide. Tell us about that, how you became interested in it and about the paper.
I was doing my graduation thesis in 1981, and I thought I couldn't touch a political issue, so I chose a humanitarian topic. I heard that one-child policy was causing a lot of girls being killed in the countryside, since China was still 90% agriculture at the time. So I decided to go do some research, and I did not realize how many girls were killed at the time. When I visited the villages, I witnessed myself hundreds of girls being killed and seeing girls being thrown in the river when their umbilical cord still fresh. I was shocked. So I wrote a report on the widespread killing and calling for the government to do something to stop killing the baby girls. And my thesis advisor really liked what I did. And then she turned it into Wenhui Bao, which was the most famous newspaper in Shanghai at the time. Then Xinhua News picked it up. At the time, China did not have authorship. So it's generally the editor would take the content and then write something called the editor's words. And that caught international media storm. Everybody picked up that piece. And then UN started sanctioning on China for human rights violation, and that's how I got into trouble. Because when that started, nobody wants responsibility. Everybody said, who did this? Yeah. And it traced back to me.
And of course, the important thing to realize is with a one-child policy, there was still a preference for male childs, and that's why females were disproportionately.
That's right. In the countryside, everybody wants boys, not girls.
So why? What's curious to me is that Xinhua, the official Chinese news agency at the time, would pick up the story to begin with.
I think the Chinese government did care about the issue. They just weren't prepared for the international media pressure. And as I said, in the early 80s, like 81, 82, China was very open. Deng Xiaoping was the leader of the country. That's when that happened.
And so now all of a sudden, you can be the author. We'll put your name on this thing now that it's become hot. And you were arrested.
Yes, I was at school. Somebody came behind me and put a sack over my head and literally carried me into a vehicle and drove about 2.5 hours. And I was thrown in jail into a room that was completely black, no lights, no water, no food for 3 days. And I thought I surely was going to be killed, and I didn't know why.
Yeah, had anybody explained to you at all why you were?
There were no explanation of why I was in jail. There was no legal procedures in China at the time.
So there you are, 3 days, no food, no water, no light, and no explanation. Then what happened?
Then on the fourth day, I was called to this room, and they told me that I'm released, and I was going to go home and stay in home and wait for someone to tell me what it is. It's only when I came out I heard why I was arrested. It was about this report I wrote. And I also heard, this was what I heard later, was that Deng Xiaoping asked what happened, and then somebody said to him, reporting to the chairman, we put the original report in jail. And then he said, why? This is not Cultural Revolution anymore. That's all he said. And then I was lucky enough being released.
That's all it took to get you released. I'm trying to imagine your 3 days in that cell after all you had been through, and now you're out. Now you can study, and you're back into that first grade situation. What was going through your mind?
I thought it was so unfair when life just turned around for me, and now I'm going to die. Now, during Cultural Revolution, there are so many things unimaginable happened, and we don't really ask for reasons, and there's just no reason. Even though that I came out of that dark age, I still had that mindset of, in China, there need be no reason to kill someone. But I just wish that it wasn't happening, and I also was thinking, like, if they were killing me, it would be better to be a method that's painless. Don't torture me. Just let me die.
Do it quickly. And I wonder, as you were writing this paper, if you had the sense, given what you said earlier, the fact that China was not the China that was had become in those couple of decades, that you believe that China was now on the way to reclaiming its past and onto a different future.
I'm a little bit ambivalent about that, because China's long history really has very, very rich culture. And Cultural Revolution is a very dark period. There are other dark periods too. That's not only one. That's just the one I lived through. And today, the modern China, of course, has much of the Western concept being mixed. In fact, it suppressed a lot of good Chinese value that I really valued in the past. So I don't really know. It would be interesting to see how modern China would be.
What was your sense at the time when you were writing this paper? Did you think you were part of what was going to be a transformation, or was this just a paper that needed to get in on time?
When I wrote the paper, I really, I like children, and I like women. And when I see baby girls being killed, it was totally the humanitarian part of me that's working. I wanted to save those babies. That was the real drive behind that.
You're released from prison, you're sent home, and then ultimately you're deported. Tell us about that and how you came to the United States.
One of my father's students was studying in New Mexico, I think. When I was be deported. I could go any country as long as I get a legal visa to leave. And it just happened to be United States was the easiest one to get at the time. I got the visa for studying English as a second language to University of New Mexico, I've never heard of. So, and then I was given a passport, $80 traveler's check, and I was told to leave and never coming back. And I was also told that I was not supposed to do political asylum and not to tell my story and just leave and shut up.
Were there any threats to you or about your family that anybody
yes.
left behind?
Yeah. Yes. The police told me that if I would do anything to irritate them, they would kill my family. That's their very common threat.
So you're on your way. Mm-hmm. You're going to New Mexico. By the way, you actually enter the country in San Francisco, right?
Yes.
Land there. And there's the first problem. Now you have to get to New Mexico, and you're just a little bit short. Tell us that story.
Yeah, I landed in San Francisco. I had an $80 traveler's check. That's all I had. The ticket's supposed to be $80 from San Francisco to New Mexico before I departed China. When I got there, it was $85. Now, in China, we have price fixing. The price doesn't change. It's not like here. So I didn't know what to do. And someone behind me in the line give the counter person $5 so I could get a ticket to New Mexico. And that was my first impression of United States. And I was like, wow, people are really kind here. They don't even know me. And that person I don't know who he is. I don't have the name. But that taught me why indulge err on generosity.
What was your impression of the United States before you got here? Where did you think you were going?
I don't have any clue what United States would be like. And I asked my cousin, and then he said, oh, United States, that's a really rich country. You're going to be step on bananas. Step on watermelons, and then hit your head on bananas. And when you fall, you have a mouthful of peanuts.
It's not a bad place. And it turns out you got a handful of bananas right there at the ticket line. They're reinforcing that idea. Now you go to New Mexico. What did you study?
I started with English as a second language. Then I studied comparative literature. Very quickly, I realized that my English was just not good enough to study at a graduate level. And I also noticed that my teacher couldn't find jobs studying comparative literature, so I need a marketable skill. That's when I chose computer science.
What drew you to computer science?
I asked around of a major that I could switch to, and then somebody told me about computer science. I asked what it is, and they said it's a man-made language, and you use it to create things. And I thought, well, I'm good with language, and if it's a man-made language, then I'm on the same footing with everybody else. So that's kind of my decision.
When you got into the computer programming, I guess it was computer science, right?
That's correct.
What about your aptitude? Did you find, was it difficult for you?
It was very difficult at the beginning. I didn't have the math and science background. Most of students in that program are engineers or math and science students, and they just seem to be so incredibly smart. But very quickly, I found that I am better at design because studying literature gave me the ability to think about structures, flows, connectivities, and consistency, and also the whole packaging. So I become known as a very good software designer, and a lot of really smart students like to work in my group, and our group's project always be the best project. And then because I wasn't that good in programming, I also bought drinks and food for the student, and I often appraised their smartness. So they all like to work with me. I didn't know that was called leadership skill at the time. It was my survival skill.
Survival skill that teaches you to surround yourself with good people and to bring your particular talent to the group. And it's the group that's going to survive and thrive.
That's right.
And the M&Ms didn't help. It didn't hurt. And when you brought the M&Ms to the group, that helped an awful lot. And also that you're good in design. So not only in the kind of intellectual architecture of a design project, the kind of beginning, middle, and end, how it holds together, but the actual graphic design, when it came time to present, that was part of your skill as well.
That's right. Yeah, the presentation, and also think outside of problem solving, to really think about in totality, what is the user think? Because when you train as a writer, you think about your audience. And the engineering discipline doesn't necessarily teach that. And so that's the part where I really contributed to all the project.
So you've got that going. You're taking computer science. And in fact, you did some work on Terminator 2?
Yes. Later, I went to work for Supercomputing Center. I happened to be given this fantastic assignment to work on computer graphics and Terminator 2 movie. And we were using supercomputer at the time, and that was the very beginning of computer graphics. I was able to working on that piece where the villain as a metal man melt into a puddle, and it's
that called, was you?
Yeah. That's called a computer morphing.
That's and how new was that, and what did you bring? Was that something that was pretty when it happened? That was a remarkable feat on the screen.
Right. That's almost like the milestone of computer graphics. I was able to bring the mathematics into that animation. Originally, it's very manual. The way that they do animation is what they call keyframe animation. And we couldn't make the metal look like metal at the time. So that really required the mathematics and physics formula to make that happen.
At what point along the way did you start to imagine yourself running a company?
I call myself a reluctant entrepreneur because initially my concept was I was going to start the company, transfer the technology, and hire a CEO to run the company, and then I'm going to go back to the university because I so very much loved what I did at the university. But of course, that's very naive. When you start a company, it's like giving birth to a baby. You have a lot of responsibilities. You can't just take it back.
Well, I want to talk more about that in a minute, but I also want to follow your journey here in the United States and ask you about what you were hearing from the folks back home. Did you stay in touch with your parents and your family?
Yes, I did, but I didn't visit them for 10 years until I became a United States citizen because it wasn't safe for me to go back as a Chinese citizen.
And when you did go back, how did that go?
The very first time I went back, it was actually kind of confusing. I went back in 1991 when China completely changed. The old China that I knew disappeared. The new China was very much of a gold rush at the beginning of 91. So I had this disillusion of I'm going from United States back to China, and then China was more U.S. in a way at the time.
So that's culturally what happened. Then when you visited your parents, what was it like to see them after all that time?
It's also bittersweet. It was really sweet to be able to see my parents and also other family members. But it was also sad because I confronted my mother about the abuse during the Cultural Revolution, which actually sent her to depression, and she almost killed herself because I confronted her. So that was a big blow.
You confronted her about the abuse that you endured?
That I endured when she lived with me, yes.
Oh, when she lived with you. Well, uh-huh. Tell us more about that because you were separated at the time you were with the Red Guard, right?
Right. When I was 13, my mother came home, and she was very unhappy. My dad was still in exile, and she was still very much being abused during the day in her daily life. So when she come home, she'd take all of her anger on me. And that left pretty deep scar on me because, first of all, she didn't raise me. My aunt raised me. My aunt was a very loving mother. I was 13. I just learned how to live on my own. And she is the intellectual, but not very emotional. She wasn't the mother that I thought it should be. I'm sure I was difficult too, but she was more difficult. So it was hard because it's one thing that you're abused by Red Guard, it's another to be abused by your own mother. So I didn't feel that I had any place to go. Now, after I came to the United States, I at one point talked to a psychologist. And as American culture, you're about confronting. My psychologist keeps saying, I need to confront my mother about it. So I did that. I actually regret I did it because it was totally against Chinese culture.
Mm-hmm. Have you since reconciled?
Yeah, she lives with me now.
So that part has changed. We're going to continue our conversation and find out more about the business with my guest, Ping Fu, CEO of GeoMagic, a 3D software company in Research Triangle Park. Up ahead, Ping Fu tells us how GeoMagic could help save the Statue of Liberty, among other things. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Ping Fu, CEO of the Research Triangle Park company GeoMagic. It's a 3D software company with clients like NASA, NASCAR, Fisher-Price, and others. Tell us about GeoMagic. How did it get started?
Well, I started GeoMagic after Netscape went crazy. I started Mosaic with Mark Andreessen at University of Illinois. So university kind of pushed me to start a company, and I thought about what I wanted to do, even though that was at internet high. I wanted to start a company that can touch people's life and it produce something tangible. So I decided to start a company that would enable design and manufacturing for 21st century.
Wait, you were starting a computer company in the 1990s with tangible results?
That's exactly
you were the only one in America doing that. You were all by yourself. Well, what kind of tangible results were you imagining?
I was thinking of 3D digitizing, how one-dimensional digitizing created the whole digital music, and how two-dimensional digitization started all the movies and publishing. And I thought, I'm in 3D, what can I do with 3D? And then I thought, wow, that is mass customization, which is customized product being produced at economic efficiency of mass production. And I really like shoes to fit people's foot, not other way around. So I was pretty audacious at the time, thinking about using technology to combine IT and hand craftsmanship.
And give us an example of how that would work.
So when I first started, I say, imagine walking into an orthodontic's office, watch the animation of your daughter's teeth changing for the next 2 years. Imagine walking into Nike Town, get your foot scanned, and picking up a custom-made hiking boots. So I went imagine a few times like that, and then I said, GeoMagic will turn those ideas into reality. And today, they are reality.
And the idea is then you can use this to actually custom so that the machinery itself can adjust to that particular 3D image.
Right. So if you have a 3D digital model that is customized design, then the machine can make anything.
Your company works with NASA, in particular since the Columbia disaster. Tell us what applications you're working on there.
Well, that is really a dream coming true because I wanted to be an astronaut and I couldn't be. So little did I know I would be working on a project to guarantee the safety return of astronaut. So that came about because the Columbia disaster was the insulation damage under the wing was not detected. And also there was no modern technology to repair it. So the Discovery mission was going out to have a new technology, A, to detect, B, to repair such a damage and guarantee the safety return. So it's a safety return mission for that run. We were fortunately being involved in that. We're putting 3D camera on the space shuttle, and which will scan the damage, and data will be sent down to the Earth, and we will compute the damage and then create the repair to that damage. It's in its exact shape, and it gets wind tunnel and simulation. We know the strength is good. Compute the milling path, which is the machine code, and send it back up to space, and they can cut out the insulation in the space station in the shape of the damage, and spacewalker can go out in 5 minutes and repair it and be safe that it will work.
And it's working.
And now every NASA space shuttle, not even NASA, any space shuttle goes to the space will use this technology.
And essentially before that, they could go out and do repairs if they knew. First of all, they have to know something happened.
Right.
But if they did, they could go out, but
they were just putting the goo into those holes, and some of those holes are pretty big.
Right.
When you're putting the goo in there, A, you don't know the strength. It's not the same insulation material. In the space, they tend to freeze, so they don't necessarily seal well.
Right, and you don't know if you've gotten everywhere.
Right.
And this also has applications in dentistry.
Yeah, that actually dentists saw that application and called and said, hey, how you repair space shuttle insulation is how, exactly how we do tooth cavity. And do you know dentists actually are artists and rocket scientists? And that's what got my interest. Yeah, now we are very big in dentistry.
And pretty much the same technology then.
Same technology. You scan the damaged teeth, you create the repair that's exactly in the shape of the damage.
Now, you got your company going, but at one point it was falling on hard times. Describe that and how it came back.
Yeah, in the early 90s, the company falls into peril of this internet rush. You don't need a revenue, you just need to drive growth, the craziness, what we call the irrational exuberance. And so the company actually almost ran out of money and got in deep trouble, and it was at the brink of death. We came back by basically focused on the innovation, which we already have, focused on really good business value, partner with a few customer like Invisalign, which correct teeth without brackets, is one of our customer then, who also saved Geomagic at the time. They were the first customized manufacturing company in the 21st century. They are actually a milestone company. So that's, and then also with both private and public funding, so access to capital was also important.
And eventually you got to work with NASCAR as well.
Yes. NASCAR engine is basically the typical case of handcraftsmanship meets technology. It's a black art why the engine runs faster. So we need to capture those black art and then replicate them in digital form so we can analyze what works and what doesn't.
So how would, I mean, but certainly people knew how to make fast engines. I mean, there were folks who knew the engines inside and out. They didn't need a 3D model to do that. They kind of, what changes things? What's different about having that 3D image?
The intake manifold in the engine is not a regular shape. It's not just a tube. It's got this irregular organic shape. And then the black master can look at it and kind of say, bend it a little bit here and do it a little bit there. So when it's just done by a craftsmanship and you can't capture that knowledge, then you can't replicate that knowledge with other people. I think with the digital technology, the power isn't that it does better than human, but the power is that it's able to replicate the best work and then let people collaborate on it.
Collaboration is an important part of your story. All of the biographies I've read and the various interviews at one point or another come down to or come back to this notion of collaboration.
That's right, yeah.
Why is that important? When did that become important to you and not sort of you're the boss, you can tell people, you know, you're pretty smart, you've been to school, here's how you do it. Now go out there and do it and come back.
Yeah, I think a collaboration is at many levels. At intellectual level is what people say when ideas have sex, they create more good ideas. I believe the collective intelligence always come out with better ideas than any others, than a single person. But I also believe in the 21st century, the corporation will have a collaboration among each other as well as among societies and people. And I fundamentally believe that even into philanthropic work, I believe in the 21st century, it's no longer about you make it big and then you give the money away. It is more about you work with others and you create more ecosystems so that everybody win. And I believe the ecosystem creates more jobs, creates better products, and then it's more sustainable.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about this idea that seems to be getting traction lately, this idea of shared value that Michael Porter from Harvard is talking about, where businesses need to see their community around them not as an externality but as part of the business plan and part of their investment scheme.
That's correct. And the shared value theorem that Porter is talking about is being spinned in many different forms. But in principle, it is a belief that a business shouldn't only look at its short-term gain or its own good. It need to look at the totality of good. And then it is believed that if you share the value with different shareholders, you would be better off. You would create better business.
And its own good is more broadly defined than the narrow quarter to quarter.
It's much broader, much broadly defined.
Now, GeoMagic reached the attention of President Obama. You spoke for the president's campaign for Startup America. First of all, how did he hear about you, and what was your role in that?
I was invited as a 50 CEOs to give President Obama advice on innovation and entrepreneurship last year. Caught attention of some Department of Commerce people and probably President himself, because they actually quoted me 2/3 of their press release. And then shortly after that, I was invited to be as a guest of Michelle Obama's box at State of Union last year. And after that, I guess I was just on their Rolodex. And when Obama wanted to form the very first president-initiated National Council for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, I was called on serving on that organization, NACI. I am actually the only person representing small and medium-sized company and the woman-led company in that council. And I'm glad I can serve that role. And then he also called me to kick off Startup America.
What do you think are his goals? What was he aiming for in both Startup America and the entrepreneurship initiative?
Part of those initiatives was our call for the Washington to put some effort into the company that we call highly entrepreneur, high growth, high impact company, because much of the stimuli money goes to small business, goes to the main street business, which are the restaurants and cleaners. They are very important for the economy, but it is the high growth company that is creating a lot of jobs, but they fall into this crack, what we call missing middle. With all those kind of companies, there would be no IPO market. So there's a lot of consequences of not putting any attention in this segment. So we were able to convince President and many of the departments that this is important, and they were able to shift the money from the existing stimuli money to squarely focus on innovation and entrepreneurship. I'm quite happy to have some influence on that move.
Well, it sounds great, and it sounds like the White House is paying attention to those very issues that you've raised. So that's the government paying attention. But what happens for a startup business in the environment, the current financial environment, where the pressure for short-term profits is so great? Is it difficult to begin a company thinking about those shared value ideas that you talked about, because the financial pressures are so great? How do you resist those to build the company that you call more sustainable?
Mm-hmm. I think the financial pressure is the same to the company that looking at a sustainable issue or shared value versus the one doesn't. But it really is true that if you build a company that you have a true intrinsic value and you're good for the community and you're good for the customer, you end up have less financial pressure, because you can't focus on financial pressure itself to solve that problem. Company exists to solve real problems. Company exists to serve real people and provide real value. That is what we need to focus on.
And what do you do? I mean, at the very start of your business, when you're planning all this, mm-hmm. how do you factor that in? What does that meeting look like?
At the very start of a business, you need to know what you really offer, whether or not it's a product and services. Why would people want to buy that, right? That's very important. You need to know that. And does that line up with your passion? Because if you don't have passion, you're not going to push that through. It's a long, winding, difficult route.
But shared value suggests that you're also going to pay attention to the infrastructure, to the school system that you're a part of, to the air quality and water quality and all those things that you could dismiss as externalities.
That's true. But that, to me, is whether or not you're a business person or you're working for a company as a citizen, we should all care about that. And just because you're a business owner doesn't relieve you any of those responsibilities. And if you have more resource, you should do more. And if you're in a position to lead your people, then you should lead them the way that you should live as a good citizen of the society.
As a matter of conscience or as a business principle, because ultimately it makes you more sustainable.
That's a very good point. I don't think a business principle should be separate from a social conscience.
Are you doing business in China?
Yes, I am. I have a subsidiary in China. Most of our business internationally are export business. Our product, GeoMagic product, is 100% made in USA. And this is one thing I said is 2 years ago when the economy crashed, we made the decision of closing down R&D centers around the world rather than closing here and sending hiring people in the lower cost region. We brought all of the R&D back to the United States because talents are available here. And we are the beneficiary of government fundings and taxpayers' money. We should hire people here. So that's part of what you're saying about, you know, is that business principle? Is that social conscious? We believe that's one. Now, we are also business conscious because we did increase profit, increase revenue. So those P&L are basic building block of for-profit company. That is not a goal. That's just a simple measure of whether or not you're good enough.
And you appear to be Entrepreneur of the Year and about to win be awarded the William Friday Award at NC State. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for being on the program. Wait, before I let you go, I've got about 30 seconds left. You are still on the watch list in China, are you not? Or are you?
I am still on the watch list, yes.
But they'll let you run your business there. That part's
I can
okay.
run my business as long as I don't call a meeting.
I see. Somebody else has to do that. You have to stay here. Thanks so much for being on the program, Ping Fu.
Thank you for having me.
Ping Fu is the CEO of GeoMagic, a 3D software company in Research Triangle Park. For more information, you can go to geomagic.com. That's the State of Things for today. Thank you for listening. Find us at stateofthings.org. Follow us on Facebook. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Bill Kumpf and Nasser Abbas are our interns. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.